This is Tell Me More, the Sunday magazine on 101.1 More FM, WBEB Philadelphia. I'm Emily Scheibert. Good morning. This week, how to be a story catcher, honoring the tradition of the stories that define our personal identities. Christina Baldwin encourages us all to find the meaningful stories right in front of us, all in this edition of Tell Me More. Storytelling, both oral tradition and written word, is the foundation of being human. Christina Baldwin, one of the visionaries who started the personal writing movement, explores the vital necessity of recreating a sacred common ground for each other's stories. In her book, Storycatcher, Making Sense of Our Lives Through the Power and Practice of Story, each chapter is carried by a fascinating narrative about people, family, or community, intertwined with practical instruction about the nature of story, how it works, and how we can practice it in our lives.
Well, I've been convinced over many decades of working with people because I've been a journal writer since I was 14, and I've been a teacher of writing and of storytelling for a number of years, and I thought, you know, story is what we really pass along to each other. And I want people to value it as much as they value any of the things that we collect in our lives that are tangible. And I recently went through an experience with my mother where we pulled all the old teacups and things out of her china cabinet that means something to her as she was getting ready to move into a smaller apartment. And she sat with all this lovely stuff on the floor, on the carpeting, and she gestured to it and said, "Who wants this?" And thinking, I'm sure, of her six young women granddaughters, and I had to say to her, none of them want it. You know, not at this time in their lives. They're finishing college. They're moving around. They don't know how to take care of a couple of little porcelain teacups. What they want from you is the story of who you are and the story that you carry of who your mother was and any bits of story that you carry of who your grandmother was. Because then these young women have a memory that extends back for 200 years that they can carry forward to their children and their grandchildren.
Yeah, and one would hate to think about losing all of those stories by simply not asking somebody to share them in some organized fashion or share them in some meaningful fashion where they can be recorded or remembered and passed along.
Absolutely. And I think because I began sort of taking charge of the story of my life at a very young age, story has really become an organizing factor for me. So when I was in ninth grade, I looked around the suburban neighborhood where I was growing up, and I thought, I don't know that this is my path. I don't know that this is how I want to be when I'm 35. You know, and when you're a young teenager, you can hardly imagine what you're going to be like at 18. But I just got very curious about what else could a woman be. And I went to the school library and the public library, and I began pulling off the shelves the biographies of women and reading everything I could get my hands on. Now, this was long enough ago, it was sort of pre-feminist movement, that there wasn't that much out there, but I began discovering books about the lives of Eleanor Roosevelt and Margaret Mead and Madame Curie and some of these other people, and I thought, oh, look at this. And I think that was probably one of the most important things I ever did for myself as a young girl, because what I began to see in those biographies is how to become a woman through story, and that there were many other stories for ways to grow up, ways to make decisions, choices that you could do with your life. And it was that that led me into journal writing and said, okay, I have to start laying out a map here. And believe me, I was not a good journal writer. I mean, I wrote all those vacuous things about, you know, hoping Johnny will take me to the homecoming dance and so forth. But embedded in there were the beginning questions of, so how do I make one more step toward becoming myself?
How does story connect us to one another?
It connects us, I think, through questioning. So that, if I can just use this little historical moment, because I was reading all those books in my bedroom, when I was around women, I would ask them questions, and they would turn around and tell me stories. You know, and it might be a question like, why did you marry Uncle Willard? Or what was it like for you to go to college here or there? Or I didn't know you used to be a nurse. What was it like to be a nurse? But every time you ask a question like that, what you get back is story. So story begins to connect us between our own idea of what we're trying to figure out in our lives and what other people have already figured out. And I don't think most of us have any idea what it would be like to try to make our way if we weren't absolutely surrounded and embedded in story, because story is the verbal map of how to be a human being.
Do you think people are reluctant to share their stories, or have you found them willing to do so or eager to do so?
I would say that both are true. I think that people who aren't thinking consciously of stories, a lot of times when I'm talking to groups, I say, you know, we swim through story like a fish swims through water. And if we could interview a fish, the last thing it would talk about is water, because it's the medium of its experience. It takes it totally for granted. And story is the medium of our experience as people, and we take it for granted. This book, Story Catcher, is really to help people remember to make story a conscious part of their everyday, because everything that comes out of our mouths is not a story. But the storyline that we develop day by day in our lives moves us forward and allows other people around us to help us move forward. So I'm really trying here to remind people to be conscious of story, to look for it, to sit down and listen to it when it starts to happen in a group of people, to create little moments for it, and even to go into writing, because journal writing has been such an important part of my own life. To imagine telling the story of yourself or your family or your work on a piece of paper or out in cyberspace, blogging, it doesn't matter, but to articulate our life to ourselves.
And there's also evidence that telling story can really help people deal with trauma, that telling story of something bad or violent or traumatic that happened actually helps in healing, doesn't it?
Yes, James Pennybacker at the University of Texas did some work and that I came across many years ago, in which he said that sitting down and telling story is even more effective than many kinds of therapy, and that sitting down and writing it is more effective than talking. And so one of the things that he prescribes to people is that any trauma that's happening to you, whether it's big or whether it's the breakup of a relationship, I mean, that people go to writing. And this has certainly been my experience as a teacher of journal writing, is that people come to me after a trauma and say, I either had to write or die, because I needed a way to organize what had happened to me and bring it into experience, which is why the subtitle of the book is Making Sense of Our Lives Through the Power and Practice of Story, that story is what organizes experience. And you see, when we live through big social collective traumas like 9/11, that it's telling the personal story and making a personal relationship to the trauma that helps us fit it in to our view of ourselves as a country, ourselves as New Yorkers, or whatever.
Does everyone have a story?
Yeah, I really think they do. And it is one of our most prized possessions. I think that it's the last thing we want to lose. I mean, people say, oh, I'd rather have a stroke that took my legs than took my power to speak. And when people have, in their aging, some kind of dementia or Alzheimer's, and they begin to lose their story, it is terrifically disorienting to them. And I was just talking to a woman the other day who does a lot of work with people in nursing homes, and she says that she coaches the families to not get impatient when they hear the same story over and over again, but to reinforce the storytelling capacity in their elderly family member, because that helps them hang on to that part of their mind. And as long as we have our story, we really believe that we're still human. And as our story moves out of our minds, we lose that sense of identity. So, and many people in my age bracket in the 50s are dealing with parents who are beginning to lose their memory. And that's the thing they miss the most. They say, it's hard to watch them age, but the hardest thing is to watch them lose. lose their story and realize whatever I don't know about them now, I will never know about them.
Yeah, and you make a good point about elders, because when that generation is gone, and we're going to lose so many rich stories. I mean, that's a generation of people that knew life before really the automobile and before refrigerators and indoor plumbing and all sorts of things that we just completely take for granted. And so there's so much that generation has to bring to us.
And they're also a generation that knew the village, especially in America. So many of us now moved out of small town life into urban or suburban life. And even those who live in small towns, it's not the same as it used to be. It's not the same when you have a mega mall in a small town and an industry that's, you know, connected to a Japanese company than it used to be really cottage industries and little farmers and so forth. And so they're holding the stories of a traditional part of American history that we may very much need in the next 50 years.
There is an art of storytelling. Do you focus on that, or do you just tell people to be real?
No, actually, I do focus on it, and I remind people. I said, when I was studying this, I went and looked at some of the brain theory, and Steven Pinker in his work has said that every society develops language. They may not develop writing, but every society develops language, and every language has at its very core how it tells stories, what he calls narrative structure. And so I remind people that a story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It has characters. It has place. And then it has a sense of something happening that shifts those characters, that creates insight. And that's an automatic tension. And as soon as we start telling each other a story, we lean forward and look at each other, or we open a page of a book in a bookstore and we can't put it down because we go, well, what's going to happen? And there's that implied understanding that something is going to happen that makes the story so compelling.
Cultures that did not have written history had oral history, and so storytelling was something that was very prized by indigenous peoples, and it's sort of interesting that we have to kind of revamp this and rekindle an interest in this subject now, since it is part of our past.
It is, and I'm more and more intrigued at what's happening globally, that literacy coming into the common people of the world is less than 100 years old. And it's not that every single person in the world now can read and write in their own language, but huge percentage of people can. And I was looking at a magazine the other day that just had pictures of internet cafes around the world, and some of these cafes have a couple of old computers and a generator out back that generates electricity on like Tuesday and Thursday afternoon, and people line up to be on the internet and blog because they don't have even paper in their village, but they can put their story someplace electronically. And the desire to be known, to reach out, to have the sense that you're putting out there in the world who you are and that you have a life somewhere in a Bedouin village in the middle of the Sahara is a deep, deep drive in us. So people do want to tell their story. And I think in our situation here, we have the opposite. We have a huge amount of distraction. We're given almost no time to ever have a reflective thought in public space. We're always being stimulated by, you know, TV screens and radios and cell phone conversations that we're overhearing or engaging in, or people on their BlackBerries. And we need time to just pause and take a breath and look around us and see who are we walking along with at this moment. For me, that's one of the saddest things. I do a lot of traveling, and everybody's on their cell phone or their computers, and I'm going, well, you're sitting right next to me. We could be having some fun. So I do that a lot. I play with people in airports and start little storytelling games.
There was an older woman who worked in the supermarket that I used to go into regularly who, as she was packing the groceries, would say, What do you like to watch on television as a way of engaging the customers in something that was completely unexpected? And I have to say, at first I was a little put off, like, you know, you're sort of startled. This isn't what I do in the grocery store. Why would you want to hear something from me? And then as time went on, I really kind of appreciated it and made a point of getting into her line so that, you know, you could share just a little tidbit of something with each other. Because I do see sometimes, as you say, people in public spaces, even the workplace, going to great efforts to not have that human kind of connection. There seems to be a little bit of squeamishness about it.
Well, on my website, storycatcher.net, I have a lot of suggestions for how to, what I call, break open story space in these ordinary moments, because I think we are getting enculturated to just close down. I mean, the cubicles are not only real, but they become metaphoric. It's like we leave them, but we still carry them with us, and we walk around in our little cubicles. And I think storytelling is a way that we can work to recreate a sense of community around us and realize that we're surrounded by friendly people. Mm-hmm. And there's so much fear in American culture right now, and it's like everyone but you is a terrorist. And I'm going, no, that's not true. And so one of the examples I love to do and that I put in the book is, I love if I'm in a coffee line waiting for the latte, and, you know, there's 10 people ahead of you and everybody's kind of like antsy to get their caffeine, I just turn to somebody and I'll say, what's your first memory of coffee? And they do give me that look like, who are you, a reporter? And I just smile at them like, and I say, I really want to know. And pretty soon, two or three or four people are all talking about, you know, their Swedish grandmother who used to boil the coffee with a raw egg, and somebody remembers getting up on school mornings and going, oh, mom's already up because they could smell the coffee. And we start creating a sense of, you know, we're kind of like each other. We may be different skin colors, we may go into different offices, but, oh, we have something in common. And it creates just that little sense of maybe the world is friendly rather than maybe the world is threatening. At one level, this is what I hope the book will do, is will remind us to look into the faces of each other and see our commonalities and look for our commonalities.
I work with a nonprofit theater company that makes theater pieces out of people's real stories, and typically there's a theme of some sort. Sadly, a lot of it focuses on trauma, violence, or recovering, let's say, from trauma. It's dealt with everything from men serving life sentences in a state penitentiary to immigrants struggling to make it in a new culture, and they take the real stories and they kind of make poetry out of it, and they put song into it, and it's performed by the real people. And it's just got an amazing power to really inspire other people and to bring a depth of understanding that we so often don't have, especially with marginalized groups of people that you wouldn't ordinarily get a chance to talk to. I mean,
Absolutely. You
don't have an opportunity to find out what it's like to have lived in an abandoned building smoking crack and that sort of a thing, and then to overcome that and go on and have a better life. So but when you go and you see people witnessing these stories, and it's not just the power of telling of the story, but as you well know, it's the witnessing, it's the hearing of the story that's an equally important piece of it. And it just helps people to connect in a viscerally human way with people unlike themselves, and yet, as you say, human, just like you.
So here's a great little story. I was driving around Chicago with a woman who was taking me to a bookstore event last week, and she was talking to me about how she loved the book, and she had just finished reading it that morning. We came up to a stop sign, and there was a man with a sign, you know, saying, please give me money, I'm hungry and cold. And she had brought, because I had just gotten off the plane, she had brought a bag of food for me in case I was hungry. And I had, a few minutes earlier, said, no, no, I'm fine, I don't need anything. Without even talking about it, between us, she just reached in the back seat, rolled down her window, and handed him this bag of healthy food. And she just called him over, and she said, sir, would you like this food? And, I mean, it was a beautiful little trendy boutique basket of food, you know, and he just held it in his hands and looked absolutely amazed. and thanked her. And we rolled up the window and drove on, and she said, you know what? I think I did that because I read your book, because I understood that he has a whole story in there. And I'm not going to know his story, but maybe I could feed him. And that's the kind of thing I hope will keep happening. And it's exactly the thing you're talking about in your theater, is that instead of people being other, they become variations of human experience. And we go, well, I haven't had that experience, but maybe I'm not so different from that person.
Yeah, you're right. And so much of what we see on the news and in the media does kind of create the me and the other, you know, very mm-hmm. much the mother who's abusing her children, the father that abandoned his family. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to say, they're not like me. I'm not like them. But when you hear the story, you perhaps are going to change your point of view and see that, you know, people are people, even in their weakest moments.
And if you really knew the story, there would be, it might be hard to identify with someone who is in the perpetrator role, you know, who is in the violent role versus the victim role. But we do have to admit that we have impulses of our own. We have been able not to follow them, but we know they're in there if we're honest.
What advice can you give us in the telling of a story? What can you do to help us become better storytellers?
I think a story works because we recreate a little bit of a world for people to step into. So even in that little scene that I spoke about, driving up to the corner and there's a homeless man holding a sign, when I say that, you see that man and you see the street corner, and it may be in Philadelphia instead of Chicago, but you can make a picture in your head. So I always say stories make a picture in our head, and it doesn't make a difference whether it's exactly the same picture or not, but it's like reciting a bit of a movie. So be sure you put in things about, that's why stories go, it was a dark and stormy night, or it was a lovely autumn day. And as soon as you say those things, pictures start rolling.
I didn't actually ask you to tell me what you mean by story catcher, which is the title of your book.
I'd love to tell you. A story catcher is someone who values story and is trying to make the kinds of moments occur in life that we've been talking about. Many times in families, it's the person who at the Thanksgiving dinner table raises a question and says, what's the funniest thing that ever happened in our family on Thanksgiving Day? And somebody goes, oh, I remember. Remember the time a mouse jumped out of Aunt Dorothy's refrigerator? And or remember when the turkey fell off the table, or I mean, all of those kinds of things. And so a story catcher is someone who, like, opens that space, usually by asking a question and then by paying attention. They don't just ask it and move on. They ask it and they turn around and they look at you. Or they sit down with the little children and they do something that they read them a story and then they say, and what's your story? You know, like if you read story about a kid who's having a hard day at school, then you say to this child, and what was your day like? And then what happened? And then what happened? Because having that storytelling capacity is hugely important to our ability to succeed socially our entire lives.
And I think that's why people mourn to some extent the loss of the family dinner table, because that is such a forum for the spoken word story. And as a kid, we were all supposed to bring something to the table, literally, in terms of a story. And we would take turns. And you couldn't just say, when asked what happened at school, nothing.
Oh, yeah.
That wasn't sufficient. And there's something about sitting facing each other that makes this storytelling more powerful than sitting together in front of the TV.
Well, I always say to people, the table didn't go away. We left the table. So the table's still there. And a story catcher in a family can be the one who says, twice a week even, you know, I know what people's schedules are like with kids in school and soccer games and whatever, but say twice a week we're going to all be at that table. And when is that going to be? And recreate that space and make it fun. You know, it isn't like storytelling is a punishment. It's fun. One of the things I've seen families do is put some kind of intriguing question in a candy dish, and everybody contributes a question. And they just draw those questions out one at a time. And so when people have an idea, and some of them are really silly or funny or whatever, but they have an idea for a story, they just put it in a candy dish. And then they'll, on Tuesdays and Saturdays, whenever their meal time is, they just open the candy dish and someone draws out a question, and that's what they use.
Can you give us any guidance on maybe introduce more ways of introducing storytelling into a family setting without seeming like a weirdo?
Well, sometimes you just have to take the risk of being a weirdo. I was sitting in the hot tub with my family at my brother's house, and it was my sister's birthday. I said to my sister, "What's your favorite memory of your birthday?" And my brother threw the rubber ducky at me and said, "Hey, it's a hot tub, not a story circle." And I laughed, and I said, "Okay." But then 5 minutes later, my sister said, "You know, I do want to tell you my favorite memory." And pretty soon, my brother was telling his. You know, so it's like, what so bad can happen? Someone can tease you for a few minutes. But I like to kind of just carry around in my mind, or sometimes even literally written down in my pocket, a couple of good questions that I think might draw people together. And what's your favorite Thanksgiving memory? What's your favorite memory of autumn afternoons? I mean, just something that doesn't drive them into their deepest, darkest secrets, but invites them to come forward with something. And reading stories is mm-hmm. just a wonderful way of bringing it back to life. I mean, I once read Lord of the Rings to my nieces and nephews. I mean, I was hoarse for months, but I thought this was a very important book for me. And I would read it every time I saw them, and then they would continue to read it. And then when I would go back, they would say, "Okay, here's where we are in the book now, but read it again. Read this next chapter to me." And just to keep it going, Harry Potter is a wonderful gift to the children of this generation in the nick of time to really get them back into the magic of story. And now many other stories are coming forward like that. I think we all can look back in our childhood and kind of go, well, here are books that helped make me. And depending on the age we were when certain books became incredibly popular, it's very different. Like my little sister loved Laura Ingalls Wilder books, but I was a little too old, you know, and I never really read those and loved them the same way that she did. And the other thing in families is to help people get comfortable with writing, maybe through scrapbooking. You know, and helping kids do scrapbooks of their school years or that kind of thing, and then saying, okay, now you're not going to remember when this picture was taken someday, so let's write a little story about it. I used to love going in to the bedroom and just saying to my stepdaughter, "What's one good thing that happened to you today?" And she would recite it to me, and I'd write it down in this little notebook for her. And then as she got older, she would do it. And so she has this whole collection of, you know, little pastel notebooks from, like, third grade to sixth grade in which she had recorded pretty faithfully one good thing after another. And she has that, and she's carrying it around with her. And I was down at her apartment in L.A., and there it is. Well, now she's going to do it for her baby. You know, she's starting to write one way that this little baby gave her joy that day. So when he grows up, or maybe when she's mad at him and he's 16 years old, she can look back and go, "Oh, yeah, this was my delight."
Well, that's a wonderful story, and there are many others. Your website, again, is storycatcher.net, correct?
That's correct.
And it's been a pleasure. Christina Baldwin, thank you so much, and much luck with the book, Storycatcher, Making Sense of Our Lives Through the Power and Practice of Story. Thanks for being my guest.
Thank you, Emily.
Christina Baldwin's book is Storycatcher, Making Sense of Our Lives Through the Power and Practice of Story. Thanks for joining me this morning. You can email the show or browse the archive. Just log on to morefmphilly.com and click on Tell Me More. For 101.1 More FM, I'm Emily Scheibert.